Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Brother Calvin. This edition of Trillion Dollar Flow. We're going to go into Ponzi schemes. Ponzi schemes and financial scams that weighs on us spiritually, mentally, and emotionally. Okay, this episode of Trillion Dollar Flow is brought to you by the Seed of Abraham Ministries, helmed by Bishop T. Turner. You can reach him at his website, which is theseedofabraham.yolasite.com, or you can give him a call at 773-577-9720. If you can't reach him by phone, go to his Contact Me page on his website and put your information in his Contact Me page, and you hit the button that go to his email instantaneously. He gets it from his phone and get back with you in a timely fashion. Okay, now, what's all that?
Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings. This is just doing a special short version of the Cal. Wanted to speak with Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. about homosexual activity. I was able to speak with him privately last week, and he shared some really interesting thoughts, and I wanted him to share that with you all briefly. I didn't want to take up too much of his time. Mr. Fuller, when I spoke with you, you said that white people tend to think of non-white people as boys and girls, and you tied that into how that relates to homosexual behavior. Could you share that with our audience so they can get a really clear picture of what you're saying?
Well, there is a system of white supremacy in place, which just means just mistreatment and domination and use of people in a royalist manner based on color. That's basically what it is. That's what racism is. It's just a variation of the of royalism, but it's based on color rather than on other things. Like lineage and who your father was and what your name was, I mean, 1,000 years ago, and certain sets of traditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what basically racism is, and it's turned out to be the most powerful form of royalism in the known universe now in the form of what we call racism and or white supremacy. Now, in any structure, that's dominant. You have to dominate the people in all areas of activity. If you don't dominate them in all areas of activity, then other areas of activity will slip away from the domination factor. And you have 9 areas, according to what I have written, that will just about cover most things. I think that's adequate enough. Economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. Now, I call sex the 8th area of activity in alphabetical order of the other areas of activity. So that just comes up as number 8. But sex is the most powerful motivating force among people next to the system of white supremacy itself. Because whatever the dominant system is, that's what people react to on the planet. So the dominant system at this particular time in history, and has been, as far back as anybody can remember, who's breathing now, the dominant system. That's mistreatment of people based on color, domination of people based on color. So the sexual aspect is the second most powerful motivating force rather than the first under this system, since the racist factor is the dominant motivating force among people, and sexual motivations are the second. Now, the racists, apparently, according to the evidence, have studied how people who are subject to them are motivated sexually. Now, if a male is a boy, which you are a boy, you're a little boy when you're born and whatnot, and then you get to be a bigger boy and whatnot, and at a certain point you reach what they call a certain degree of maturity, which is decided according to the social system that you have at hand, you're now entering the threshold of what they call manhood. So you go from boys to men. Females go from girls to women, and that's the normal process in most societies. So what the racists did was look at that and said, well, you when you have a system of racism, you only have one man and one woman category, and that would be the masters themselves. You can't have your victims of the system growing into manhood and womanhood. So if they start trying to be men, if they go from boys to men, now you have a problem. You have a bigger problem than you had before. When they were boys, they were completely dependent on you. They understood that they'll do your bidding, and they're easier to control. Same way with the girls who are trying to be women. But when they start thinking that they are men, you're not going to have but one man in the house of white supremacy, and he's got to be white. And you're not going to have but one woman, and she has to be white. So now it defies logic that you would allow them to go from boys to men. So if you're not going to allow them to go from boys to men, what will you allow them to do? Because they are constantly growing, they are constantly getting smarter, and they have a natural tendency to want to break away from boyhood and to become men. So what you do is divert them away from wanting to become men and have, if it's a male, have him go from boyhood to femalehood. In other words, he changes his gender altogether, at least in his mind. Then he's easier to control. Then you do the same thing with the female. Take the black female, and rather than allow her to go the normal progression of things, steer her in the direction away from becoming a woman and in the direction of becoming a male. In other words, she will switch genders in her mind. Now, her body didn't switch genders, but we can probably do some things that give her the illusion that her body can be made to switch genders too. Now, when you do that, what you have is confusion. You have added confusion. And one of the best ways to control people for a long period of time, particularly if you confuse them sexually, is through confusing them sexually so that you have a male thinking he's a female or wanting to be a female, even if he's struggling and trying and whatnot and trying to do everything that a female does, but he doesn't have the physical equipment. But he's got it in his mind anyway. He's just determined he's going to act like one and be one and do the things that females do and look at males like a female looks at males normally. And then over in the female column, have the female do the same thing. Only thing about it, she's not going to try to grow into womanhood. She's going to try to do everything that she sees males doing, including in the bedroom. Try to become an artificial male. And she can do this in her mind because the mind is very flexible. A person can actually think that they are a bird if they want to. But before they try to fly or jump off a building, it's best that they get their equipment for doing so. You know. So that's the way that works. And when you can get people on that roll and when you have people subject to you, you can always propagandize anything. You can make anything look like it's the fashion because you set the rules for the society. So that's what's going on. I tried to be as comprehensive as I possibly could in that description, and I hope that people could understand what was being said.
Yes, sir.
So that's what we have now. We're heading in that direction now, full steam ahead.
And when I spoke with you, I said that, you know, the counter-argument that I frequently hear is that, well, there are a lot of white people who are also participating in so-called homosexual activity. And, you know, it's this is not something where they're just trying to trick black people into doing it. You have people who are born so-called gay or homosexual, and, you know, this is no trick at all. If it was, you wouldn't see all these white people going around and doing it and being mistreated because they are participating in these so-called homosexual acts. What would your view on that be?
Depends on how it plays out in the end. Now, if the system of white supremacists remains intact, then that will prove the supposition just outlined. That will prove that it's valid, that it is designed basically to support what is already in place. Otherwise, you would have a major, the system of white supremacy would go out of business. There would be no reason to keep it in business. If the white people were serious about really getting rid of racism and getting rid of what they call all of the sexual and gender categories and all like that, because racism is an artificial category. See, just because people are of different colors doesn't say that they are members of a race. That's an artificial construct. No one is supposed to be a member of a race. That's something completely made up. So if you can, you can do the same thing with gender. You can see, do the same thing with a lot of things. But you have to wait until it reaches a certain point where you've got enough evidence to prove the proposition that you made in the first place. Now, like I say, this is my concept of the way things are going, because there is still a system of racism in place. Now, if racism is still in place, when all of the so-called anti-sexual, that's what I call it, behavior, comes to full fruition, and everybody's accepting of it, everybody's participating in it, or embracing it, or parading it around and saying that it's the best thing ever discovered since ever, okay? Now, and you still have a system of racism in place, then that will have proved the supposition, because ordinarily, all of racism would disappear. But see, it's designed to lure. Now, here's where I based that on, the luring part. In the history of the system of white supremacy, there's a thing called whiskey. It was very popular, the use of it. Now, if you are a practiced deceiver, one thing that you know about the science and the art of deception, you cannot deceive people into doing things unless you are doing quite a bit of it yourself. If you're going to be what you call a real arch deceiver, and the white supremacists have proven that they are arch deceivers, they are very skillful at deception. So in order to deceive people, you can't get people to drink whiskey, and you're sitting there never drinking any of it yourself. So there's some historical record of this. So what they'll do, a deceiver will sit there and practice drinking whiskey under controlled conditions. You know, take a little sip, know exactly where the point is where you get good and drunk or where you don't get good and drunk. Then once you learn what they say, and some people brag about it in bars and whatnot, said, hey, I can drink you under the table, meaning they can outdrink you, that you will drink. I mean, that they will drink and you will drink. But when they drink, they don't get drunk. But you wind up drunk. Many males who have tried to deceive females into sexual activity, you know, back in the days when whiskey was a bigger thing than dope, used to get into the booth in the restaurant and start that process. Say, now what I'll do, I'll know she's not willing really, but she'll be willing before the night's over, because I'm going to get her to drink some of this stuff that I brought with me. And he'll be drinking and she'll be drinking. He'll take a sip, she'll take a sip. Next thing you know, she's willing to go along with anything. She doesn't know what she's doing, but he does. Now, many a person, particularly pimps, understand that thing very well. Now, it's the same way with whiskey as it was used, according to the record of white supremacists themselves, in dealing with people who are called Indians. Sit down, Chief. We're going to have a Thanksgiving Day. We're going to thank give thanks for all of the wonderful things that have been done for both me and you by our Maker, by the great spirits. And in fact, I brought some spirits with me. It's in a bottle. You never had anything like this before, but you will want it after you get it. It's called fire water. It's full of spirits. It'll give you spirit like you have never had before, Chief. And the Chief said, well, what's wrong with just pure water from the river, from the great streams of our lands? Say, oh, yeah, but you never had nothing like this. This is something we made in a factory. It's got water in it. No mistake about that. But we got a little alcohol and a few other stuff, a little other stuff that I've added here. It'll pep you up, give you another perspective on looking at the mountains altogether. Might be good stuff. So he gives it to the Chief. And at the same time, now, the Chief is a little suspicious. So he's drinking right along with the Chief. So that means everything must be okay. So he's drinking. I'm drinking. Next thing you know, the Chief is under the table. Chief's not used to it. And you feel the white supremacist, while he's drunk, or when he begins to come out of the stupor, says, okay, Chief, I got some paper here I want you to sign. I'm going to give you $22 for Manhattan. Now, when the Chief really gets sober, see, now he's angry. He wants to go on the war path. But he's already signed everything away. And what was the instrument for doing it? Deception through an act of using whiskey. Now, the whiskey, you know, that's working all over the world and they're starting to do it in South Africa, in Thailand, and other places and whatnot, is sex and anti-sex. Oh, you don't need to be a female all the time. After all, females have to go through a lot of agony. Wouldn't you like to be like your brother? Well, I don't have the equipment of my brother. Oh, well, you can pretend that you have it. I got some stuff I can sell you in the store. Strap-ons, you name it. And you just get it in your head that you should be a male. Because males can get things done. They got privileges that females don't have. And you say, well, you know, I don't particularly, you know, the lady says, I don't particularly want to be a male and all like that. Well, it's something, you know, have you tried it? You don't know it. Don't knock it if you ain't tried it. And knowing black people, particularly in this area of the world, we like anything that looks like it's bordering on something new. Because we're so tired of everything that ain't new. And they won't know, we'll go for it. We'll pioneer, you know, we'll lead the parade, which is what they try to get us to do. Now, you can't get a decent place to stay. You can't get a decent job. But if you want to lead the gay parade and you're black, they will reserve a spot for you. If you don't believe it, try it. That's what I mean by evidence of what I'm talking about. The record shows this. And they start with who? The youngest. Okay. Always work with them in the choir and churches and whatnot. And they do it through the most intelligent of black people. They don't start with the fellow sitting there with the wine bottle in front of the liquor store who's 40 years old. Because he's a black male. That's why he's drinking. He's been disallowed to ever be a man, and he knows he'll never be one. He'll always be a boy. And that is tearing him up inside. That's why he left his wife, left his children, and all like that. I mean, he gave up on everything and started drinking. That's why he's sitting on the curb out there. Because he's still struggling to be a man. And he will fight people right there in that parking lot about his manhood. So you can't hardly get to him, even when he's drunk. You say, oh, man, get away from me. Don't be feeling on me. I got this big hip woman out here, you know, this big leg woman out here, you know. You know, if I want to do something like that, that's who I'm going to get with. I don't want you. Get your old rough, dirty hands off of me, you know. Man, I like women, you know. I'm a man, you know. I'm a man. Look at me. I'm a man, you know. I don't want no man. Even when I was in the joint, I didn't want one. See, that's the way he'll talk. He's 40 years old, okay. But what do? They go around and get the teachers and the guys who are going into the ministry, and that's where they spread that gospel. among black intellectuals. Because the street dude, see, he's still struggling. I mean, he ain't going to never make it, because you can't be a man under the system of white supremacy. You got to remain a boy or turn into a female.
Mm-hmm.
By turning into a female, I mean having the kind of ideas.
This morning I would like to use as a subject from which to preach the drum major instinct. The drum major instinct. And our text for the morning is taken from a very familiar passage in the 10th chapter as recorded by St. Mark, beginning with the 35th verse of that chapter, we read these words: "And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came unto him, saying, Master, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we shall desire. And he said unto them, What would ye that I should do for you? And they said unto him, Grant unto us that we may sit, one on thy right hand and the other on thy left hand, in thy glory. But Jesus said unto them, Ye know not what ye ask. Can ye drink of the cup that I drink of, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said unto him, We can. And Jesus said unto them, Ye shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of, and with the baptism that I am baptized withal shall ye be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared." And then Jesus goes on toward the end of that passage to say, "But so shall it not be among you, but whosoever will be great among you shall be your servant. And whosoever of you will be the chiefest shall be servant of all." The setting is clear. James and John are making a specific request of the Master. They had dreamed, as most of the Hebrews dreamed, of a coming king of Israel who would set Jerusalem free and establish his kingdom on Mount Zion and in righteousness rule the world. And they thought of Jesus as this kind of king, and they were thinking of that day when Jesus would reign supreme as this new king of Israel. And they were saying, now, when you establish a kingdom, let one of us sit on the right hand and the other on the left hand of your throne. Now, very quickly, we would automatically condemn James and John, and we would say they were selfish. Why would they make such a selfish request? But before we condemn them too quickly, let us look calmly and honestly at ourselves, and we will discover that we too have those same basic desires for recognition, for importance, that same desire for attention, that same desire to be first. Of course, the other disciples got mad with James and John, and you can understand why, but we must understand that we have some of the same James and John qualities. And that is deep down within all of us, an instinct. It's a kind of drum major instinct, a desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be first. And it is something that runs the whole gamut of life. And so before we condemn them, let us see that we all have the drum major instinct. We all want to be important, to surpass others, to achieve distinction, to lead the parade. Alfred Adler, the great psychoanalyst, contends that this is the dominant impulse. Sigmund Freud used to contend that sex was the dominant impulse, and Adler came with a new argument saying that this quest for recognition, this desire for attention, this desire for distinction is the basic impulse, the basic drive of human life, this drum major instinct. And you know, we began earlier to ask life to put us first. Our first cry as a baby was a bid for attention. And all through childhood, the drum major impulse or instinct is a major obsession. Children ask life to grant them first place. They are a little bundle of ego. They have innately the drum major impulse or the drum major instinct. Now, in adult life, we still have it, and we really never get by it. We like to do something good, and, you know, we like to be praised for it. Now, if you don't believe that, you just go on living life, and you will discover very soon that you like to be praised. Everybody likes it, as a matter of fact. And somehow this warm glow we feel when we are praised or when our name is in print is something of the vitamin A to our ego. Nobody is unhappy when they are praised, even if they know they don't deserve it and even if they don't believe it. The only unhappy people about praise is when that praise is going too much towards somebody else. But everybody likes to be praised because of this real drum major instinct. Now, the presence of the drum major instinct is why so many people are joiners. You know, there are some people who just join everything. And it's really a quest for attention and recognition and importance. And they get names that give them that impression. So you get your groups, and they become the grand patron. And the little fellow who is henpecked at home needs a chance to be the most worthy of the most worthy of something. It is the drum major impulse and longing that runs the gamut of human life. And so we see it everywhere, this quest for recognition. And we join things, overjoin, really, that we think that we will find that recognition in. Now, the presence of this instinct explains why we are so often taken by advertisers. You know, those gentlemen of massive verbal persuasion, and they have a way of saying things to you that kind of gets you in the bind. In order to be a man of distinction, you must drink this whiskey. In order to make your neighbors envious, you must drive this type of car. In order to be lovely to love, you must wear this kind of lipstick or this kind of perfume. And you know, before you know it, you're just buying that stuff. That's the way the advertisers do it. I got a letter the other day, and it was a magazine coming out, and opened up. Dear Dr. King, as you know, you are on many mailing lists, and you are categorized as highly intelligent, progressive, a lover of the arts and the sciences, and I know you will want to read what I have to say. Of course I did. After you said all of that and explained me so exactly, of course I wanted to read it. But very seriously, it goes through life. The drum major instinct is real. And you know what else that happened or causes happen to happen? It often causes us to live above our means. It's nothing but the drum major instinct. You ever see people buy cars that they can't even begin to buy in terms of their income? You've seen people riding around in Cadillacs and Chrysler who don't earn enough to have a good T Model Ford. But it feeds a repressed ego. You know, economists tell us that your automobile should not cost more than half of your annual income. So if you make an income of $5,000, your car shouldn't cost more than about $2,500. That's just good economics. And if it's a family of two and both members of the family make $10,000, they would have to make out with one car. That would be good economics, although it's often inconvenient. But so often, haven't you seen people making $5,000 a year and driving a car that costs $6,000? And they wonder why their ends never meet. That's a fact. Now, the economists also say that your house shouldn't cost, if you're buying a house, it shouldn't cost more than twice your income. That's based on the economy and how you would make ends meet. So if you have an income of $5,000, it's kind of difficult in this society, but say it's a family with an income of $10,000, the house shouldn't cost much more than $20,000. Well, I've seen folk making $10,000 living in $40,000 and $50,000 houses. And you know, they just barely make it. They get a check every month somewhere, and they owe all of that out before it comes in. Never have anything to put away for rainy days. But now the problem is, it is the drum major instinct. And you know, you see people over and over again with the drum major instinct taking them over, and they just live their lives trying to outdo the Jones. They got to get this coat, because this particular coat is a little better and a little better looking than Mary's coat. And I've got to drive this car because it's something about this car that makes my car a little better than my neighbor's car. I know a man who used to live in a $35,000 house, and other people started building $35,000 houses, so he built a $75,000 house, and then somebody else built a $75,000 house, and he built a $100,000 house, and I don't know where he's going to end up if he's going to live his life trying to keep up with the Joneses. There comes a time that the drum major instinct can become destructive. And that's where I want to move now. I want to move to the point of saying that if this instinct is not harnessed, it becomes a very dangerous, pernicious instinct. For instance, if it isn't harnessed, it causes one's personality to become distorted. I guess that's the most damaging aspect of it, what it does to the personality. If it isn't harnessed, you will end up day in and day out trying to deal with your ego problem by boasting. Have you ever heard people that you know, and I'm sure you've met them, that really become sickening because they just sit up all the time talking about themselves. And they just boast and boast and boast. And that's a person who has not harnessed the drum major instinct. And then it does other things to the personality. It causes you to lie about who you know sometimes. There are some people who are influence peddlers. And in that attempt to deal with the drum major instinct, they have to try to identify with the so-called big name people. And if you're not careful, they will make you think they know somebody that they don't really know. They know them well. They sip tea with them, and they this and that. That happens to people. And the other thing is that it causes one to engage ultimately in activities that are merely used to get attention. Criminologists tell us that some people are driven to crime because of this drum major instinct. They don't feel that they're getting enough attention through the normal channels of social behavior. And so they turn to antisocial behavior in order to get attention, in order to feel important. And so they get that gun, and before they know it, they rob the bank in a quest for recognition, in a quest for importance. And then the final great tragedy of the distorted personality is the fact that when one fails to harness this instinct, he ends up trying to push others down in order to push himself up. And whenever you do that, you engage in some of the most vicious activities. You will spread evil, vicious, lying gossip on people because you are trying to pull them down in order to push yourself up. The great issue of life is to harness the drum major instinct. Now, the other problem is, when you don't harness the drum major instinct, this uncontrolled aspect of it is that it leads to snobbish exclusivism. It leads to snobbish exclusivism. Now, you know, this is the danger of social clubs and fraternities. I'm in a fraternity. I'm in two or three. For sororities and all of these, I'm not talking against them. I'm saying it's the danger. The danger is that they can become forces of classism and exclusivism, where somehow you get a degree of satisfaction because you are in something exclusive, and that's fulfilling some, you know. And I'm in this fraternity, and it's the best fraternity in the world, and everybody can't get in this fraternity. So it ends up, you know, a very exclusive kind of thing. And you know, that can happen with the church. I know churches get in that bind sometimes.
Make it plain.
I've been to churches, you know, and they say, we have so many doctors and so many school teachers and so many lawyers and so many businessmen in our church. And that's fine, because doctors need to go to church, and lawyers and businessmen, teachers, they ought to be in church. But they say that, even the preacher sometimes will go all through that. They say that as if the other people don't count. The church is the one place where the doctor ought to forget that he's a doctor. The church is the one place where the PhD ought to forget that he's a PhD. The church is the one place that the school teacher ought to forget the degree she has behind her name. The church is the one place where the lawyer ought to forget that he's a lawyer. And any church that violates the whosoever will let him come doctrine is a dead church. And nothing but a little culture with a thin of religiosity. The church is true to its so it will let him come. Not whosoever will let him come. And it does not supposed to satisfy the perverted uses of the drum major instinct. It's the one place where everybody should be the same, standing before our common master and savior.
Yes?
And a recognition grows out of this that all men are brothers because they are children.
Yes.
Of a common father. From the instinct lead to exclusivist one's instinct. Lead one deal. And can lead one to feel that because he has some training, he's a little better than that person who doesn't have it. Or because he has some economic security, that he's a little better than that person who doesn't have it. And that's the uncontrolled, perverted use of the drum major instinct. Now, the other thing is that it leads to tragic, and we've seen it happen so often, tragic race prejudice.
This recording is briefly interrupted at this point.
We see with our own eyes. In fact, not too long ago, a man down in Mississippi said that God was a charter member of the White Citizens Council. And so, God being the charter member means that everybody who's in that has a kind of divinity, a kind of superiority. And think of what has happened in history as a result of this perverted use of the drum major instinct. It led to the most tragic prejudice, the most tragic expressions of man's inhumanity to man. The other day I was saying, I always try to do a little converting when I'm in jail. And when we were in jail in Birmingham the other day, the white wardens and all enjoyed coming around the cell to talk about the race problem. And they were showing us where we were so wrong demonstrating. And they were showing us where segregation was so right. And they were showing us where intermarriage was so wrong. So I would get to preaching, and we would get to talking calmly because they wanted to talk about it. And then we got down one day to the point, that was the second or third day, to talk about where they lived and how much they were earning. And when those brothers told me what they were earning, I said, now, you know what? You ought to be marching with us. You just as poor as Negro. And I said, you are put in the position of supporting your oppressor. Because through prejudice and blindness, you fail to see that the same forces that oppress Negroes in American society oppress poor white people. And all you are living on is the satisfaction of your skin being white and the drum major instinct of thinking that you are somebody big because you're white and you're so poor you can't send your children to school. You ought to be out here marching with every one of us every time we have a march. Now that's a fact. The poor white has been put into this position where through blindness and prejudice he is forced to support his oppressors. And the only thing he has going for him is the false feeling that he's superior because his skin is white and can hardly eat and make his ends meet week in and week out. Now, not only does it stop, I mean, not only does this thing go into the racial struggle, it goes into the struggle between nations. And I would submit to you this morning that what is wrong in the world today is that the nations of the world are engaged in a bitter, colossal contest for supremacy. And if something doesn't happen to stop this trend, I'm sorely afraid that we won't be here to talk about Jesus Christ and about God and about brotherhood too many more years. If somebody doesn't bring an end to this suicidal thrust that we see in the world today, none of us are going to be around Because somebody's going to make the mistake through our senseless blundering of dropping a nuclear bomb somewhere, and then another one is going to drop. And don't let anybody fool you. This can happen within a matter of seconds. They have 20 megaton bombs in Russia right now that can destroy a city as big as New York in 3 seconds with everybody wiped away in every building. And we can do the same thing to Russia and China. But this is why we are drifting, and we are drifting there. Because nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world. And I am sad to say that the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America. Because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken. God didn't call America to do what she's doing in the world now. God didn't call America to engage in a senseless, unjust war as the war in Vietnam. And we are criminals in that war. We've committed more war crimes almost than any nation in the world. And I'm going to continue to say it. And we won't stop it because of our pride and our arrogance as a nation. But God has a way of even putting nations in their place. Amen. The God that I worship has a way of saying, don't play with me. He has a way of saying, as the God of the Old Testament used to say, the Hebrews, don't play with me, Israel. Don't play with me, Babylon. Amen. Be still and know that I'm God. If you don't stop your reckless course, I'll rise up and break the backbone of your power. Yes. And that can happen to America. Yes. Every now and then I go back and read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And when I come and look at America, I say to myself, the parallels are frightening. We have perverted the drum major instinct. But let me rush on to my conclusion, because I want you to see what Jesus was really saying. What was the answer that Jesus gave these men? It's very interesting. One would have thought that Jesus would have condemned them. One would have thought that Jesus would have said, you are out of your place. You are selfish. Why would you raise such a question? That isn't what Jesus did. He did something altogether different. He said in substance, oh, I see. You want to be first? You want to be great? You want to be important? You want to be significant? Well, you ought to be. If you're going to be my disciple, you must be. But he reordered priorities. And he said, yes, don't give up this instinct. It's a good instinct if you use it right. Yes. It's a good instinct if you don't distort it and pervert it. Don't give it up. Keep feeling the need for being important. Keep feeling the need for being first. But I want you to be first in love. I want you to be first in moral excellence. I want you to be first in generosity. That is what I want you to do. And he transformed the situation by giving a new definition of greatness. And you know how he said it? He said, now, brethren, I can't give you greatness. And really, I can't make you first. This is what Jesus said to James and John. You must earn it. True greatness comes not by favoritism, but by fitness. And the right hand and the left are not mine to give. They belong to those who are prepared. And so Jesus gave us a new norm of greatness. If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. And this morning, the thing that I like about it, by giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great. Because everybody can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and your verb agree to serve. You don't have to know about Plato and Aristotle to serve. You don't have to know Einstein's theory of relativity to serve. You don't have to know the second theory of thermodynamics in physics to serve. Yes. You only need a heart full of grace.
Yes, sir. Yes,
sir. Soul generated by love. You can be that servant. I know a man, and I just want to talk about him a minute, and maybe you will discover who I'm talking about as I go down the way. Because he was a great one. He just went about serving. He was born in an obscure village.
Yes, yes.
The child of a poor peasant woman. And then he grew up in still another obscure village where he worked as a carpenter until he was 30 years old. Then for 3 years, he just got on his feet and he was an itinerant preacher. And he went about doing some things. He didn't have much. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never had a family. He never owned a house. He never went to college. He never visited a big city. He never went 200 miles from where he was born. He did none of the usual things that the world would associate with greatness. He had no credentials but himself. He was only 32 when the tide of public opinion turned against him. They called a rabble that turned against him. They called him a rabble rouser. They called him a troublemaker. They said he was an agitator. But if not, there was a day when many of the Israelites found themselves in bondage in Babylon. There was a king of Babylon by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. You read about him a good deal in the book of Daniel, and it stands as an epic that will remain stenciled on the mental sheets of unfolding generations. Nebuchadnezzar was a mighty king. And when he ruled, he ruled. And when he issued an order, he meant business. And Nebuchadnezzar issued an order. He made a golden image, and his order was that everybody under the reign of his kingship had to bow before that golden image and worship it. Now, those of you who read the Bible remember that story. One day, Nebuchadnezzar called in the judges and the governors and the sheriffs, and they had a dedicatory service for this golden image. And then he said to them, I'm instructing you to see that everybody bows before this golden image. But there were three young men around there. One's name was Shadrach. The other one's name was Meshach. And the other name was Abednego. And they answered, and I read it from the scripture, and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this manner. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Now I want you to notice first here that these young men practiced civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is the refusal to abide by an order of the government or of the state or even of the court that your conscience tells you is unjust. Civil disobedience is based on a commitment to conscience. In other words, one who practices civil disobedience is obedient to what he considers a higher law. And then there comes the time when a moral man can obey a law which his conscience tells him is unjust. And I tell you this morning, my friends, that history has moved on. Great moments have often come forth because there were those individuals in every age and every generation who were willing to say, I will be obedient to a higher law. These men were saying, I must be disobedient to a king in order to be obedient to the king. And those people who so often criticize those of us who come to those moments when we must practice civil disobedience never remember that even right here in America, in order to get free from the oppression and the colonialism of the British Empire, nation practiced civil disobedience. For what represented civil disobedience more than the Boston Tea Party? Never forget that everything that Hitler did in Germany was legal. It was legal to do everything that Hitler did to the Jews. It was a law in Germany that Hitler issued himself that it was wrong and illegal to aid and comfort a Jew in Hitler's Germany. But I tell you, if I had lived in Hitler's Germany with my attitude, I would have openly broken that law.
Make it plain.
I would have practiced civil disobedience. And so it is important to see that there are times when a man-made law is out of harmony with the moral law of the universe. There are times when human laws are out of harmony with eternal and divine laws. And when that happens, you have an obligation to break it. And I'm happy that in breaking it, I have some good company. I have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I have Jesus and Socrates. And I have all of the early Christians who refused to bow. Now the second interesting point is that these men never doubted God and his power as they did what they did. They made it very clear that they knew that God had the power to spare them. They said that to the king. Now we know that the God that we worship is able to deliver us. And that grew out of their experience. They had known God. They had experienced God in nature. They knew God as the Creator. And then they had seen God in history.
Yes. Make it plain.
And then they had seen God, I'm sure, in their personal lives.
Yes. Amen.
They never doubted God's power to deliver them. But let me move now to the basic point of the message. No, this morning, if we forget everything I said, I hope you won't forget this. They came to the point after saying our God is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. But if he doesn't deliver us, we still are not going to bow. But if not, do you get that? These men were saying that our faith is so deep and that we've found something so dear and so precious that nothing can turn us away from it. Our God is able to deliver us, but if not, this simply means, my friends, that the ultimate test of one's faith is his ability to say, but if not. You see, there is what you may call an if faith, and there is a though faith. And the permanent faith, the lasting, the powerful faith, is the though faith. Now the if faith says, if all goes well, if life is hopeful, prosperous and happy, if I don't have to go to jail, if I don't have to face the agonies and burdens of life, if I'm not ever called bad names because of taking a stand that I feel that I must take, If none of these things happen, then I'll have faith in God. Then I'll be all right. That's the if faith.
Amen.
You know, a lot of people have the if faith. Jacob found himself in that dilemma once, and his faith was contingent on an if. And he said, now, if God will be with me,
yeah,
and if he will keep me in this way that I go,
yeah,
and if God will give me bread to eat,
yeah,
and raiment to put on, that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. That's the if faith. Jacob hadn't quite gotten to the essence of religion. There is a though faith, though. And the though faith says, though things go wrong,
yes, sir,
though evil is temporarily triumphant,
yes, sir,
though sickness comes and the cross looms,